Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 4th of October. Many of the signs say we are the 99%. Some of the chants are working people are getting shafted. We got sold out. This hour of the program, we'll be talking about the Occupy Wall Street protests that have been going on since September 17th on Wall Street, and news in yesterday's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is local offshoots of the Occupy Wall Street demonstration are being organized in Wisconsin. Organizers in Milwaukee, Madison, and Appleton planning rallies October 15 as a part of an international day of action in support of the protests. This hour will have two guests with us, one who's concerned about these protests from a conservative point of view and another who will explain what exactly they're all about. Are there demands? Who are the people who are protesting? The police reaction to the protesters and the way they've organized all of this as well is rather interesting, with people making a statement and everybody in the crowd repeating what a person said, who must be it must be very empowering for the person who is talking. Why they have used that particular tactic. And I know that we are going to have many phone calls this hour. Our first guest is Richard Eskow. He's senior fellow at the Campaign for America's Future. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Josh Barrow will be joining us later, fellow at the Manhattan Institute, regular contributor on a National Review Online, who has some concerns about the way the people are protesting, blocking bridges, etc. We start with Richard. Richard, hello. Thank you for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure to have you. Tell me how all of this started. It seems almost as though it was spontaneous. Did it start in Canada with Adbusters?
Well, it started online, I think, is the safest way to say it. And yes, Adbusters is a magazine with a kind of anti-corporate populist political mission, and they're based in Canada, and they were integral to this whole effort. And it's not entirely clear, you know, what role other groups played in it, but basically the idea germinated online, and from there spread to an idea of a demonstration that would be organized and conducted by people acting without leaders and without organizational support or grants or any of those things, just coming together based on their shared frustration with the way things are now and understanding of a need for change. So that's what happened. They came together and began demonstrating and formed their own spontaneous, organization, democratic processes, and all of that stuff. It's really very, very impressive, actually, to see up close and to talk to these folks. They've done a great job. You know, a lot of them are quite young. They're very bright and committed, and pretty impressive the way they've stepped in and created something from nothing in a short time.
It is very unusual to listen to them and to watch it. When you talk about it being a consensus and without leaders, that's a rather extraordinary thing, isn't it?
Well, it is. It really is. And, there's been a lot of debate among people on the left, whether you call them progressives or liberals, about how to raise public awareness around economic injustice and all of those things. And while people were debating and contemplating and doing all that sort of thing, these guys just went out and did it and overcame a lot of skepticism and a lot of negative media coverage or just being ignored, and kept at it, and have started attracting some fascinating allies, labor unions and people like that. So it's really, for something that's only been around since September 17th, it's really picked up a lot of momentum pretty quickly.
And did the reason that the people came there, was it primarily these issues, or is it beyond this over-concentration of wealth around Wall Street, a very, very small number of people making an extraordinary amount of money, and the influence of money in politics?
You know, yes and no, meaning that obviously the group was called Occupy Wall Street, and Wall Street was the target of their demonstration. So certainly Wall Street's past behavior and lawbreaking and its role in the financial crisis was a big part of it, and so was the unequal distribution of wealth. But they were adamant, they got a lot of heat for this, including from some on the left, that they were adamant that they were not going to come in with a series of policy prescriptions. They were not going to say, well, we want a tax on financial transactions, or we want a higher marginal tax rate for the wealthy. They wanted to let this movement define itself around the issue of economic fairness, and that turned out to be very smart, because around that issue, of which there's so much frustration, people are coming in and saying, we agree with you, we want to support you, because we agree with the general principle that our country's not being run in a fair way anymore, that the wealthy have too much power and too much control, and that's why they're getting the airline pilots union came in and showed support. You know, that's why they're getting these unusual groups. One of the members of the group told me yesterday that they were getting emails from soldiers in the field.
Really?
Expressing support, you know, emails from Afghanistan and Iraq, saying that in their own private business, not in any way, you know, defying orders or anything like that, but just in their own lives, they were adopting some of the principles of democratic assembly that these guys at Wall Street had put together. And, you know, this young woman of 24 told me she was moved to tears by all of this. So I think by creating an open, you know, the techie types would call it open source, you know, by creating a movement where people can come in and contribute their own ideas, they've really come up with something that I think is very interesting, and we haven't seen, you know, there are only a few precedents for it. The demonstrations in the 60s, the civil rights movement in the 50s, which everybody thought was bound to fail. A lot of people have drawn the connection between the Arab Spring and Tahrir Square in Egypt, and including people who've studied both places. I was in Eastern Europe a lot for my work during the fall of communism, and I see a lot of parallels there, too, with what went on in Hungary and Czechoslovakia and the Soviet Union. I mean, really, people coming together saying, we don't like this system, so we're not going to demand that Mr. Gorbachev, you know, or Wall Street change X or Y. We're not going to start there. We're going to start by saying there are elements of the system we object to that need to change.
But don't you need to go beyond that? Don't you need to ask for something in order to receive something?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the young woman I was talking to yesterday said, if we ask Wall Street for something, we're acknowledging that Wall Street has the power. You know, it's a very interesting, you know, I think that they're in the process of saying we're building a movement, not demanding a specific policy. I think, yes, if you talk to any number of them, they would say, you know, we should go back to a more rational tax structure, and rich people should pay their fair share, and Wall Street should be investigated for its crimes and so on. But I think that if they were to say, for example, we want a tax on financial transactions to slow down all the gambling and make Wall Street contribute, without developing a mass movement to support that, then there would probably be some kind of watered-down tax. People would say, you got what you wanted, now go home. And the end result would be that they'd figure out, you know, I was in the corporate world and Wall Street world for many years, they'd figure out a way to get around it, and the underlying attitudes of the country wouldn't change, and there wouldn't be a movement to say, no, that wasn't what we were talking about. So I think they're in the organizational phase right now, and the consensus building phase, and not in the policy prescription, you know, part of the process.
You mentioned the airline pilots. You mentioned soldiers in the field giving support. Who else? Are there other organized labor? Are they there in full force?
Well, you know, it depends on how you define full force, but yes, they've been getting a lot of support from organized labor. The Transit Workers Union in New York has, if you know New York at all, and I know our audience is Midwestern, but the Transit Workers Union are not hippies, okay? These are not, you know, peace and love folks. These are the people who run the trains and operate the buses and clean the, you know, the stations and so on. These are not you know, love children. And the head of that union said, the demonstrators and us are singing the same song. That was his quote. We support them 100%. So they've got support from the transit workers union, and they've got support from local SEIU branch, which is, of course, a major union. A nursing, you know, and medical care branch has been coming in and talking to them about first aid and giving them sort of advice and support that way, as well as expressing support for what they're trying to do, because, you know, they see a connection there. I think these union groups, I think more union groups will sign on, too, because I think they see corporate power and the way it's controlling politics as hurting them, as hurting the middle class, and I think they're right. And I think, you know, eliminating the middle class as we've always known it for the last 70 years or so. So I think that we'll see more and more of this union connection, which is, I think, significant.
I heard a union guy, I can't remember who he works for, on national news last night, who said, and I think he put it quite succinctly, and a lot of people would agree, actually, with what he said, working people are getting shafted.
Well, yes, that's the point. And, yeah, that's pretty succinct. And I think it's very, very true. I think we're seeing an erosion of support. You know, and you historically, you had this sort of simple breakdown where Democrats were supposed to be more aligned to working people in the middle class, Republicans to higher income people, and that was how people always thought of the two-party system, I think. And now you have a system where corporate donations are so powerful that both parties have been bending their knee to corporate interests. And by the way, I don't think corporations are evil. I just think they're acting in their own self-interest, and that's contrary to that of working people in the middle class. So, yeah, I think people are getting shafted. I think you've got very few people on the national or local political scene who are saying, hey, you know, we're going to stand up for the middle class and for people who work for a living. So you've got crazy inequities. You've got hedge fund billionaires paying 15% on their hedge fund earnings, while cops and firefighters pay 28 or 30 or 35%. So, yeah, I think a lot of people are getting shafted. I think there's a lot of frustration. Interestingly, I think the Tea Party tapped into that. I mean, they've had a lot of corporate backing, but I think they were smart in trying to channel that frustration to their corporate policies before someone else beat them to it. And I think it's the Tea Party who might be feeling also threatened by all of this. But look, this is fascinating because people are getting shafted. They're getting sick and tired of it. So since there's no political party unequivocally speaking for them, they're acting on their own there in Wisconsin, and they're acting on their own in New York City, and now a number of other cities are joining in, and we'll see what happens from here. But this is people getting shafted, saying, you know, we're kind of sick and tired of this. You know, these demonstrators talk about, they have a website called We Are the 99%, where the people who are not the wealthiest 1% come in and tell their stories about how this ongoing depression that so many people are living in is affecting them personally. And, you know, I would encourage people to go take a look at that. It's compelling stuff. And I think that is what this is all about.
Is October 15th the day in many cities in the country? I mentioned at the top of the show what's happening in Wisconsin on that day. Will the support demonstrations be taking place all over the country, do you think, or do we just not know?
Well, you know, I don't know, because this thing is moving very fast, and a number of other cities have already begun to act. There are already activities going on in Southern California. They began over the weekend and in a couple other cities. Right now I'm here in Washington for the week. The Campaign for America's Future conference is going on now, and on Thursday, tomorrow afternoon, there's going to be a rally. Thursday, there's going to be a rally. So this thing is kind of rolling out in stages, and I'm hearing a lot about additional activities later in the month. But you know, honestly, I'm not clear on what's happening when in your part of the country, for example, but I know this thing is moving quickly.
Richard Eskow is our guest this hour, senior fellow at the Campaign for America's Future, and we're talking about Occupy Wall Street. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, hour number two of our program, we're going to be speaking with one of the 24 people on Earth who went to the moon. Astronaut Al Warden will be joining us. He was command module person for Apollo 15. He has written about that experience in Falling to Earth and Apollo 15 Astronauts' Journey to the Moon. Let's go to phone calls. Diane in Milwaukee. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I did not see anything on the corporate media for the last 3 weeks until this weekend about this movement. And I have low vision, so I don't get my news off the computer. But I'm very disappointed with public media, with public TV and public radio, that they must have known about something happening in New York. And there was not a word on your station or on the NewsHour on Channel 10 in Milwaukee, which is public TV, or Channel 36. And I expect more. I expect better news, better information from public radio because I pay for it, not just through my taxes, but I'm a contributor. And I just want to say how disappointed I am that you're not giving us more than the corporate media.
Are you disappointed in media coverage, Richard?
Yes, I can't speak specifically to your stations, but nationally, it's been astonishing. You know, you really have a situation where you conduct a simple thought experiment. You know, ask yourself what happens when 50 Tea Partiers show up outside Congress. You can see the vans from all the different networks lined up all the way around the block. Here you have anywhere from several hundred to as many as 2,000 people in place for 3 weeks. And there's been almost, especially for the first 2 weeks, a complete blackout on what they're doing. Occasionally, a reporter would find somebody who took their clothes off or something or painted their face and do something that, you know, makes the whole thing look silly. Or the New York Times covered it, but in the most biased and negative way. So, yeah, it's really been, I can't say surprising, but very, very disappointing to see the kind of blackout combined with disparaging coverage that these people are getting.
And I don't want to be too self-congratulatory, but we have certainly done everything we can to cover these issues on many, many shows here. So maybe we were late to the party to talk about this particular protest, but we had it in mind to do this. We just had other shows, big shows to do last week. So, but we are definitely, we've got our eyes and ears and we're trying to gobble up as much information as we can. So I hope those shows meet to your satisfaction from all viewpoints, Diane, as well. Ralph in Little Suamico. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call, Kathleen.
Sure.
I had called in a couple other times, never did get on, but it was basically on the similar subjects. And I think the important thing here, and, you know, your guest has hinted at this, is that as long as Wall Street can divide the conservative groups and the liberal groups, they're going to win. If you listen to Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul talk, they're all talking very similar, which is basically that we've got to get out of backing and supporting Wall Street. We've got to allow Wall Street to fail when they make mistakes. Capitalism only works when it's allowed to fail.
Richard.
Well, sure, absolutely. And listen, I spoke at a demonstration last year at the Treasury Department, and, you know, I gave my usual troublemaking talk. And since AIG was part of the subject of the demonstration, and I worked at AIG, you know, I had some things to say on the subject. And afterwards, a reporter came up from one of the right-wing news media and said, you know, nothing that you said up there couldn't be said at a Tea Party rally. And my answer, my response was, invite me. I'll go. I'll talk to those guys. You know, I mean, there's a lot that they do and say that bothers me, but economically, they understand that they're being shafted. They want to do something about it. And, you know, yes, I do think they're being manipulated at times, but I absolutely think Ron Paul, look, Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders, the Senate's only self-described socialist, and Ron Paul's a conservative libertarian, they got together with a great idea, which was to audit the Federal Reserve and find out just what's being done to rescue these banks in our name. So absolutely, this is not strictly a left-right issue, and I'd like to see more people really talking about that. And, you know, the free market, if you really want to espouse the rhetoric of the free market, these guys running Wall Street did a lousy job running their companies. They ran their companies into the ground and got rescued, and they're still there. And if we really had a free market, somebody that runs their company badly loses their job and loses their fortune. And if we really had a system of justice, somebody that breaks the law would be doing a perp walk and not a vacation walk, you know, on their Hamptons Beach house, you know. So I think there's a lot. If you're for law and order, enforce the law, and that's supposed to be a conservative thing. If you're for the free market, which is a conservative thing, let the market work. So, yeah, I do think there are some left-right linkages here for sure.
And do you think, Richard, one of the reasons that it took a while for this to build was that people are just starting to see their paychecks be diminished? The power of collective bargaining in places like Wisconsin has been virtually eliminated. A lot of students are graduating and can't find jobs, so you only have a 55% employment rate, which is incredible among 18 to 29-year-olds in this country. Everybody's feeling much more of the pain, and they're hearing about bonuses that people on Wall Street are getting while, you know, they're shipping sipping champagne watching these protests, is what I've read. That there is working people really are feeling this now. They're having a hard time. They're having a really hard time, and it would appear as though not many people are paying much attention to this.
Well, you know, look, everything starts small and grows. We don't know where this is going to go. But yes, I think that, look, regular people have been feeling this for a long time.
Right.
And it's getting worse and worse. And I think there was a period after the financial crisis where first they thought, well, we'll give it to the Democrats and they'll fix it. And then some people thought, well, in 2010, we'll give it to the Republicans and they'll fix it. And I think they've gotten to the point of saying it's not getting better. They're not talking about jobs, which we need. They're not talking about wages, which we need. They're not talking about financial security, which we need, or helping underwater homeowners. They're talking about the deficit as if that were the most important thing in the world, which it is if you make $10 million a year and you don't want your taxes to go up. But they're saying, look, these people don't get it. We got to do it for ourselves. And I think that's why now people are beginning to say, you know, we can't trust politicians. We have to take action for ourselves. I think that's what we're starting to see.
Andy in Lake Geneva, hi.
It was a stocky triple.
What, Andy? Andy. Andy, are you there?
I was just on the phone here. Hey, I want you to call me. I want to make sure.
All right, Andy.
I don't think Andy's with us.
I know. It sounds like he's listening to baseball or talking baseball to me, which I fully understand. Call us back, Andy. Frank in Madison. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Frank.
Great program.
Thank
important
you,
topic. I would like to ask the guest the question, but and refer to the indiges in Spain. The Britain Uncut people, they've been resisting the Tory coalition for 2 years. There was the USA Uncut movement, and the reference to Stephen Hessel's essay. He's a 98-year-old resistance guy from before the Second War, who said, the interests and the people who I fought against are back, and it's time for the current generation to begin to resist. And, of course, the essay is Indignez-vous, get mad. And there's a very strange failure to recognize this is going on. Certainly the Arab Spring was noted, but in North America, the resistance in Britain and in Spain went unnoted, and it's clear that the media didn't recognize previous resistance in the United States. The 350 people were going to jail, and that was considered at most peculiar, and Al Gore organized his Reality Day, which again, although it was structured, it was a media event, and no one paid attention to that. And I would think that there's a great correspondence between the people who are beginning to recognize the need for the resistance and the failure to recognize events that show it's possible. It's a very important omission, and it has to stop. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, let's see. Frank had a couple points, but I think, you know the basic one. Look, I mean, I think he's right in a couple senses. One is we were encouraged to develop a global economy with free trade and outsourcing, and our banking systems are interlinked. We have, as a result, a common set of economic problems and a middle class being squeezed and pressured and shafted throughout the industrial world, and I think that's been part of the uprisings. What we had was a global banking system that gambled, destroyed the economy, got bailed out by the public, and then immediately turned around and said, we want to make sure we don't pay to repair the damage we caused, so we're going to promote a kind of austerity economics that says now we have to cut social services and opportunities for middle class and lower income people. That's what they did in Great Britain. It's that when they elected the government that's in there now, it's extremely unpopular with the public. It's created dissatisfaction and rioting, which of course was terrible, but was a response to enormous economic pressures. There are very legitimate organized peaceful movements to protest that in Great Britain and throughout Europe, which is understandable. We have greater wage inequity and wealth inequity in this country than we have in Egypt. So when the Arab Spring, among other things, comes up and protests the wealthy there and the oligarchy there, I mean, we need to keep that in perspective, that we have enormous wealth maldistribution here. And as far as the 98-year-old gentleman, look, this is the perennial struggle between the wealthy and the public and the people. So, yeah, this has come back, and we fought it before. We got to fight it again, and so we're at it. One quick thing I just want to throw in here, by the way, because
sure.
I know your next guest is going to say that he's disturbed by the protesters blocking the bridge.
Right.
I've now talked to a number of people who have said they were encouraged by the police at one end of the bridge to use the street because the pedestrian walkway was so crowded, and at the other end of the bridge there were vans waiting to arrest them for using the street. Mm. So they did not intentionally block the bridge, although that's one of the popular stories. But and I think if you read up on what New York City's done to peaceful demonstrators since 2004, there's a history of this stuff. So, but I will agree with Frank that this is a global problem and there's a global response forming.
Thanks, Frank, for the call. Let's go next to Joe in Milwaukee. Hi, Joe.
Hi. You know, you touched on this earlier, these Tea Party types, they have a lot in common with the problems that these protesters are trying to address. What's it going to take to get these guys involved in this thing?
Well, here's the thing. When people are frustrated and they know they're getting a raw deal, they look around. It's only human. Well, who's doing this to me? Why is this happening? And the Republican corporate guys who organized Dick Armey and these people who organized the Tea Party gave them an easy answer. It's those union guys. It's that bus driver making $50,000 a year that's ruining your life. So that's what they've decided is the enemy now, working people who make a living and public employees and that kind of thing. So I think what it takes is to say to them, look, that's not the problem. The problem is, you know, it would take 500,000 truck drivers or bus drivers or sanitation workers to make up for the tax break we gave the top 20 hedge fund managers in this country. And that, you know, they all talk about the good old days of the 50s. Rick Perry says, I'm looking for the country that existed when I was a kid in the 50s in Texas. Well, the top tax rate in the 50s in the United States was as high as 90%. And nobody's suggesting going to 90% again. But if you want the country we had in the 50s, you got to ask people to contribute something close to what they contributed in the 50s. So we got to tell people, look, it's the corporate manipulation of politics and the news that's keeping you from getting back the country we used to have.
Thanks for the call. John in La Crosse, hi.
Yes, hi. How are you today?
All right, John, how are you?
Well, been happier, been younger.
Well, I hope you're happy again, but you may not be younger.
Yeah, well, live in hope.
Right.
I guess I have concerns. The Republican Party and the Democratic Party are the two fundamental parties of this country primarily. And what the Republicans are, the people that call themselves Republicans or politicians, are not acting like Republican politicians. What they're acting like are people that, if they don't get their way and be in power, are going to try and overthrow the country. They're trying to do it by controlling elections. They're trying to do it by getting people out of power like they've done in a couple of states where they simply kicked the elected officials out of office and send in somebody to take charge. We have to start fighting these people in politics. Anybody that votes Republican isn't voting for a Republican politician. They're voting for somebody that wants the power and wants to keep the power and don't really care about the people voting for them. We have to start fighting back by voting Democrat. Right now, I'm not saying Democrats have the perfect solution. They've had their way at times in history, but we've got to do something to fight them. Otherwise, you're going to see what it was back in the 50s. First, you're going to start seeing good people start breaking the law, start robbing people, start stealing food just to survive.
All right, let's get a response. Do you think it's Democrat or Republican, or is that not part of the equation, Richard?
Well, no, I definitely think it is part of the equation. I think that, you know, we don't have a Republican Party in the traditional sense now. What we have is politicians like Scott Walker who get their marching orders in memos from the Koch brothers and their organization, their ALEC, you know, about this is what we expect you to do, and they do it. So I think that, you know, personally, I'm not aligned with a party, but I don't think there are very few Republicans on the planet right now who don't operate that way. The Democrats will break your heart time and again because they're also out there looking for corporate contributions and so on. But the lower down the food chain you go, the less that's likely to be in terms of local versus national and so on. And I think that, you know, the one advantage of Democrats is, first of all, there's some great ones. I mean, there's in Congress, there's some terrific folks, but and at a local level. So, but also the other advantage of Democrats is that they can be pressured. So if you inundate your Democrat with phone calls saying, I don't like the way you're voting, or I don't like you repeating the Republican talking points that make no sense about deficits or whatever, they've got to listen. I mean, the Republicans know they'll just go back to the Koch brothers for more money. So in that sense, I don't think electing Democrats is a solution, but I think it can be part of a solution if you vote for them and then make sure you pressure them like crazy as soon as they, walk into their office for the first time, because that's what it's going to take, is an independent citizenry that's not attached to electing Democrats, but is attached to electing people who can be persuaded to do the right thing and then persuading them.
Let me ask you about an interesting article that was in The Atlantic. You probably saw this. Daniel Indiviglio is the author. He says several things. Let me just toss a couple sentences. Take what you want. The Tea Party accomplished something very key. It helped to significantly alter the makeup of Congress through the 2010 election. It had a goal to put out of power the big government candidates. It accomplished that goal. The Occupy Wall Street cannot hope for any result as significant. He also talks about the fact that the U.S. is a center-right nation. Congress reflects that. Some cities are farther to the left, but the message of Occupy Wall Street isn't likely to catch on. And he also talks about the U.S. needing to maintain its healthy, vibrant banking system. And banking is one of the few industries in the U.S. the U.S. has left where we're a global leader. Your response to any of that?
My response to any of that is not subject for broadcast on the public airwaves.
Whoa!
So what I will say simply is this. It's not only horse you-know-what, but it's demonstrably and provably horse you-know-what. We have poll after poll after poll after poll, which shows that a majority of Republicans want corporate tax loopholes closed. Not just a majority of Americans, a majority of Republicans. A majority of Republicans want Social Security and Medicare benefits protected. Not a majority of Americans, a majority of Republicans. On issue after issue, 81% of people polled want the federal government to do more to help the poor. On issue after issue after issue, 76% of Tea Party members want to see Wall Street crimes investigated. 75% of Tea Party members want to see Social Security protected. So the fact that these guys can find a national platform to say absolute nonsense is just unbelievable. And to call the banking sector a healthy area where we're a global leader is like Chicago bragging that we're a global leader and because we got Al Capone, we got the best crime organization in the world. You know, Wall Street doesn't create jobs. It destroys jobs. That's how it makes money more often than not. So when we have an economy, before the crash, banks and financial institutions earned 40% of corporate profits, where historically it was down about 20%. That means that's money that's being made without employing a single worker, and often through hedge funds, by betting against workers, by betting that companies will fail, and by outsourcing and all these things. So the idea that because we're a quote-unquote global leader in banking, that banking's making money by sending jobs to other countries. So that guy, either intentionally or unintentionally, is playing his readers for suckers when he says something like that,
all right,
because we're global leaders in banking by destroying the middle class in this country. So, and through criminal behavior. So, you know, that's just ridiculous.
We'll go to one more call, and then it's time to say goodbye to you. Benita in Green Bay. Hi.
I've mentioned this a few times on talking to different programs on public radio. This Occupy Wall Street, to me, should also be these people should who believe in this should play one corporation against each other so that we help the corporation who treats the worker the better.
Richard.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that I don't know if it's Occupy Wall Street's job. I mean, I've been saying for a long time that, you know, a lot of movements, for example, the people who are fighting to protect Social Security really ought to get together with companies that sell products to older people to say, why don't you support us in our fight, because it's in your economic interests and it's in the interests of good citizenship, and we all want our parents and grandparents to live comfortably, so how about you support us on this? And I think the same thing is absolutely true. You know, I have the National Association of Small Manufacturers and other groups that support small businesses, for example. These banks and large corporations, they're not only destroying the middle class, they're destroying the medium and small-sized businesses that hire people and contribute to wealth. So, you know, I think there are people out there, there should be more of them, saying, you know, the companies that help people and that actually offer real products and hire real people to do it should be fighting the mega corporations that send jobs overseas or just make money by speculating and gambling and destroying jobs. And in that sense, I think it's a good idea.
Richard, thank you very much for being with us.
You bet. It's my pleasure.
Richard Eskow, Senior Fellow at the Campaign for America's Future. Josh Barrow, a fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a regular contributor to the National Review Online, wrote an interesting piece. You're not allowed to walk in the road. We'll find out what he thinks about the 700, perhaps more than 700, people who were arrested for walking across the Brooklyn Bridge on Saturday and his response to this movement. Our phone number remaining the same. Your call's still applicable, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us now is Josh Barrow. He is the Walter Wriston Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, focusing on state and local fiscal issues, co-author of the Empire Center for New York State Policy's Blueprint, A Better Budget, and he wrote a piece that caught our attention, You're Not Allowed to Walk in the Road, in which he talks about Lower Manhattan being not just a symbolic place for protesting. It's a place that people live and work, and people need to get around, including by driving over the Brooklyn Bridge. He got stuck in a nasty traffic jam, and he is concerned about that, and we'll talk about that, and his general reaction to this protest that's taking place, which is growing. Josh, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure, good to be here.
Yeah. So what was your take on what happened here? Our last guest said he's talked to a number of people who were protesting who said the police told people to walk across the road because the pathway, the other bridge, was just too crowded and then arrested them on the other side.
So I have not seen any accounts in press where protesters have claimed that the police actually told them that they were to walk across the bridge. What I've seen a lot of said in press is that protesters looked up in the crowd and there were these police who appeared to be leading them across the bridge, and you had a lot of statements like, the police never told me that I wasn't allowed to walk in the road. It sounds like basically what happened is you have this huge throng of protesters trying to get across the Brooklyn Bridge, and a lot of them are going on the pedestrian walkway. And then you have some of them entering toward the road, and you have police at the front with bullhorns saying you're not allowed to walk here, but because it's a big crowd, they can't be heard in the back. And eventually the group starts walking, and you had a lot of people in the back who I think were honestly under the impression that they were, you know, just following the crowd and are allowed to walk in the road. But I haven't seen, you know, in the New York Times or the AP or any of the other groups that have covered this, I haven't seen anybody actually claim that they were told by a police officer they could walk in the road.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk generally about these protests, which evidently are going to, who knows what's going to happen with them, but indications are there may be more cities participating in the weeks ahead. I think what came from our discussion the last part of the show is that the theme is that working people in this country are getting shafted. What do you think?
Well, I think the protesters are clear that they're very angry. They're upset about the wealth in the financial sector not being shared in the rest of the economy. What the protesters are not clear about is what they want. There's no apparent policy agenda coming out of Occupy Wall Street. You hear very broad statements like that they don't like corporate greed and they don't like poverty and inequality, and you know those sentiments are fine. But I don't see any actual, you know, if you're trying to get social change, you have to have, you know, things you want the government to do differently from what it's doing now. And I don't see any policy guideline coming out of this as to what the government could do to make these protesters feel like they were getting a better deal than they are.
Do you think there is a substantial difference between Republicans and Democrats and how they're dealing with issues like social inequality or whether or not workers are getting shafted? Or are the protesters, some of them, correct in saying it's really corporate donations that are so powerful and who cares who they go to?
There are absolutely important policy differences between Republicans and Democrats on issues like how generous the social safety net should be. I mean, you see the big fight that was had through all of 2009 and much through 2010 about the new health care law, with Democrats pushing for that and Republicans opposing it. There are important differences on tax policy in terms of both how much the government should collect in tax and how progressive the tax code should be. Now, it's true that a lot of these protesters are to the left of both the Republicans and the Democrats, and that's going to be true in any representative democracy. You'll tend to have political formation around two political parties, and then there will be people who are more extreme than either of those parties, either on the right or the left. That doesn't mean that the system isn't working. It just means that these people are far from the nation's political median, and therefore they're not likely to get the policies that they want out of Washington.
And yet it would appear to me, although it's kind of an amorphous event that's taking place, it's hard to know, as you say, what people want. But it seems as though the number of people who are there are working people. They're people who may be in unions. They may be young people who are finding that they can't find a career pathway. There are a lot of people who seem to be legitimately concerned that the American dream just isn't working for them.
Well, I certainly agree that, you know, there's a fair amount of diversity among the crowd that's protesting. New York Magazine did a poll. It's not scientific, but they interviewed 100 protesters at the protest site, and they found a variety of political views. But it was, you know, a variety on a spectrum. Basically, you know, they asked people to compare themselves to, and it's basically a spectrum from Paul Krugman to Noam Chomsky. So there's quite a bit of diversity in the crowd, and I think there's a diversity and exactly what the grievances are, but it's certainly a phenomenon that is left-wing, far to the left of either the nation's political median, and I would say to the left of the mainstream of the Democratic Party in Washington.
Far to the left, how so? What's left about it?
Well, because there's no specific policy agenda, it's hard to say exactly, but a lot of the protesters are anarchists. And I did an interview on CBC News yesterday, with a representative of Occupy Wall Street, and he was essentially rejecting the idea of public policy because his view was they can model an ideal society in Zuccotti Park and show America how, you know, what an alternative to a capitalist system is that would be happier. I mean, so this is, you know, to the extent that it's, you know, you can have a debate about whether we should have higher taxes on the wealthy, whether there are certain new regulations that ought to be imposed on Wall Street, but I think there's a significant element down there that rejects the capitalist system altogether. And so that's certainly a left-wing position.
Let's go to phone calls. We still have tons of people on the line. John in Sheboygan, hi.
Well, my original comment was about the what I'm going to call profound police brutality that is not only occurring on Occupy Wall Street with the macing of the women who were penned up in some kind of cage or something, based on the video I saw, but also, just the whole idea what we talked about is that, you know, these protesters, you know, getting off topic of my original comment, these being anarchists, you know, they're really not against capitalism. They're against the kind of crony capitalism and, unfettered capitalism that only benefits just the smallest of people in this country.
Josh.
Well, so two things. On the police side, I mean, we've all seen the videos of the pepper spraying, and I agree that that can't be defended, at least, you know, in my view, based on what we've seen in those videos, and the NYPD ought to be investigating that, and there is an internal affairs investigation going on right now with those Anthony Zuccotti incidents. On the other hand, with regard to the bridge arrests, which was the vast bulk of the arrests that have happened so far in this in these protests, there have been a lot of complaints from the protesters that, you know, the police shouldn't have arrested people for walking across the bridge. But I haven't seen any complaints that those arrests were anything other than orderly and professional. So I think that by and large the NYPD has been conducting itself well. But there's that notable exception that we've seen in those videos that needs to be dealt with. On the topic of whether the protesters are anarchists, some of them certainly have the viewpoint that the caller described, and they are not opposed to a capitalist system. system. They just want reforms. But others are, in fact, self-described anarchists. As I say, it's a diverse crowd with a set of viewpoints that ranges from the left to the very far left. But there certainly is a substantial element involved in organizing this that actually is anarchist. And in fact, I think that's part of why the protests are themselves so disorganized. It's not as though the left in America is without a capacity to organize around a policy agenda. You have labor unions and other organizations that can do that in many cases quite successfully. But there is an element to these protests that is opposed to the idea of organization basically at any level in society.
And yet our previous guest talked about airline pilots who are supportive, also soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq who have sent many messages of support. So it goes beyond anarchism.
Well, as I say, it's an amorphous protest with a wide variety of participants.
We have about a minute left. Rob in Radisson. Hi, Rob.
Good morning. Yeah, I'd say I think what these protesters want is some prosecutions of people on Wall Street that had questionable transactions, at the very least, business transactions, I'm saying. But that's not my point.
Well, let's make it your point because we only have 30 seconds left. It's a good point. Why didn't anybody go to jail for what happened on Wall Street? Should they have, Josh?
Well, I mean, in order to go to jail, you have to be convicted of a crime. A lot of what went wrong on Wall Street had to do with things that were legal that shouldn't have been, regulations that weren't in place, things that didn't have to be traded on exchanges that should have been, and that led to markets that were vulnerable to collapse. So certainly there are cases being prosecuted, and there are people who should be prosecuted. But the main things that we need to do to prevent future financial collapses like we had in 08 don't have to do with criminal prosecution of what happened in the past, but with changing the rules going forward so that the things that were perfectly legal that went wrong last time won't be allowed again.
Thank you, Josh, very much for being with us. Josh Barrow, a regular contributor on National Review Online. Richard Eskow, senior fellow at the Campaign for America's Future, with us the bulk of the show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We're going to talk with one of the 24 people who's been to the moon in just a moment. So please stay with us. A great conversation ahead. Thanks for all of your calls, everyone. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You'll also hear all the latest news coming up momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.